Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to today's Football Times Jurgen Klopp special. There's no way in the world that we couldn't do this, but for those of a certain hue, you know, they'll always be determined not to like him. But I think for those who aren't necessarily of an anti-Liverpool disposition, they find it very difficult to dislike Jurgen Klopp. On Friday, he launched the bombshell news that he was leaving at the end of the season. As a Liverpool supporter, obviously it was a spanner in the works. You know, looking forward to the weekend, and then suddenly it's a very different weekend. 2 years left on his contract at the end of this season. I don't think any Liverpool supporters were under any particular illusions that he would extend beyond that. I think a lot of us were quite surprised that he extended the contract a year or so ago, or whenever it was. So in a way, you know, I think he'll be going pretty much when he was originally planning to do so. But yeah, within that, Dave Bowler. Welcome, Dave.
Good evening, Stephen. On this this sad occasion for all Liverpool supporters, we should all have our black armbands on. I feel for your pain there.
Yeah, I think even for kind of like non-Liverpool supporters, it's got to be a duller landscape, English football.
I think it will be for sure. I mean, I think he's been there at the same time as Guardiola, and in different ways they've made a monumental contribution and a big change to English football, taking it into a different dimension, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. And joining us as well tonight, David Turner. Welcome back, David.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Your thoughts on the news from Friday?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. My first emotion, and we'll talk about emotions a lot, I think, tonight, is sadness. You know, somebody who clearly loves a club, who clearly loves a project of his life, and he's walking away from it. And it'd be interesting to explore that. As Dave said, you know, he's added a lot in terms of colour and coaching. And it will be interesting to talk about the pressures on coaches and how we end up in this sort of situation.
I mean, Dave, as close as you can get to a contemporary Bill Shankly, I think in the modern game, I mean, obviously I've got my Liverpool hat on, but for a manager and a club to so suit one another, it's a difficult act to pull off in the modern game.
Absolutely it is. I mean, you know, you may disagree given your loyalties, but I suppose Alex Ferguson and Manchester United were a fit in the same way. I mean,
yeah,
Guardiola, magnificent as he is at Manchester City, I don't know that he's there because it's Manchester City. You know, I think Guardiola could be a manager at any major club and be as successful. You know, I think Klopp was made for being the manager at Anfield. You know, you mentioned Shankly. I think he's very much in that lineage. You know, I think he's got a similar mentality. I think, you know, his ability to galvanise supporters, you know, never mind what he does on the pitch, and you know, we'll come on to that later. And David's obviously far better qualified to talk about that. But I think the way he gets the community, he understands that fan base. I mean, I was there right at the start, funnily enough. You'll remember, Stephen, when the West Brom played at Anfield. It wasn't his first game. It was one of the first two or three. And God only knows how. But Albion were winning going into the last 60 seconds or something. And then I think it was Origi scored. And it was a 2-2 draw. And at the end of that game, Klopp was on the pitch. And, of course, we've all become used to it now, banging his chest and saluting the crowd and all of that. And I know at the time a lot of Albion supporters took against him for that, thinking, bloody hell, it's only us, you know, I wouldn't get that excited. But I mean, I think that kind of summed up the way he was, because he understood the importance of the crowd at Liverpool, the value he could get from them, and how important it was that they were all on the journey together, if you like. And that was right there, right from that very first moment. I don't think they ever sort of looked back from that. It took a while to start winning trophies and so on, but I think that was a statement moment, and that was really interesting to watch that going on. So we're kind of privileged the way things have worked out since then to have been there, really.
Indeed, indeed. Just looking up the numbers of the 2015-16 season. Yeah, it's his seventh game in charge, that West Brom game. I always remember that first one being away at Tottenham. There was a like-for-like with Rafa Benitez there. Benitez's first game in charge of Liverpool was away at White Hart Lane. But yeah, it was amongst that first cluster of games. I mean, David, those initial days of Jurgen Klopp's, I mean, there was certain kind of misunderstanding in a way, I think, for some aspects of what he was doing. And yeah, I remember the West Brom game and, you know, the ridicule for kind of like the celebration at the end that went on a long, long time. And then there was a line in the sand somewhere where people just stopped mentioning it because, you know, the penny dropped a little bit.
With Klopp, it's a very unusual expression of emotion, not usually associated with coaching, not usually associated with English coaches or coaches coaching in England. But he's always been that expressive. He's always been that emotional at the other clubs he's been to. He cultivates a deep connection with the fans and the club and identifies with them. And as we've said already, he's a great match for Liverpool with that. But I think people were suspicious early on of those emotional displays. One of my former students who writes about emotion used a lovely phrase. He said that coaching is usually emotionally anorexic. You know, we don't deal with emotion. We don't openly talk about it. I remember another game, I can't remember who it was, but it was a game where Liverpool were losing and the Liverpool fans were leaving early and climbing up the stairs. And Klopp came out, I think, afterwards and said, I felt lonely in that moment. And that was the start of him building that complicity with the fans. You know, that we're all in this together, good or bad times, and we need to emotionally kind of support each other. So I guess there was that suspicion and he had to win people round. But Klopp, in his biographies, is described as a Menschenfanger, which is a German word which means a people catcher. And in terms of describing Klopp, what it means is he gets people on board with the project. You know, he gets them emotionally involved with it. And his teams in the end with Liverpool, I would say, were characterised by them being more than the sum of their parts. And that's a wonderful thing when it happens in football and in coaching.
That kind of like, I was... been of the mind that even when Klopp walked into Liverpool, because Liverpool had this between kind of like that 30-year hiatus in league titles, there was a set pattern to Liverpool's kind of, I don't know, ebbs and flows, I would describe them as. You know, Souness, you know, was a, you know, very complex range of his era. But from Roy Evans onwards, there was this sense of regeneration, you know, hope, a challenge for the title that would be unrequited, and then there would be a regression, and eventually kind of club and manager would fall out with one another, supporters in, you know, as well, and then it would be in came Gerard Houllier, rinse and repeat. You know, there's the hope again, there's the challenge for the title, there's the broken heart, back round to the Sadat again, here comes Rafa Benitez. It went again, it rolled into Brendan Rodgers, you know, in that 13-14 season that defies belief, really, in the great scheme of things. And then it came to Jurgen Klopp, and in came Jurgen Klopp, and it was a club that was still quite wounded from that 2013-14, you know, unrequited attempt at the title. You know, so Klopp had, despite him being who he is, he had an uphill struggle to turn the club around, and also to kind of, I don't know, ask the supporters to kind of believe again. And that was the phrase was believe, you know, to believe in the club and to believe in, you know, its you know, potential to be able to reach out and break that spell and win that league title again. You know, I think for what's gone on ever since, you know, in more recent years, it tends to be forgotten just how he had to change, I don't know, the mindset of the supporters, and you have to imagine the people behind the scenes at the club as well.
The truth is, however anybody else wants to look at it and think about their club and so on, there are only two giantly great English football clubs, and that's Liverpool and Manchester United, in the sense that they have dominated and dominated and dominated for periods, you know, in the post-war world, I suppose. And I suppose in the same sense that Alex Ferguson had to do all those things at Old Trafford, perhaps Klopp had to do even more, you know, given the scale of Liverpool's achievement, given all those European Cups that they'd won, and then given that it was such a long time that they'd never won the Premier League at all. So it was, it was a different landscape, and all the clubs had then come through as you know, with the money of Chelsea and so on. So I think it was an even bigger ask to put Liverpool on the right footing. But equally, and again thinking about him in terms of Shankly, he understood the power that was there to be harnessed, again off the field rather than on it. That, you know, David's talked about the emotion. There is no more emotional crowd. Maybe you could argue with Leeds United at times when Elland Road really goes berserk, but I don't think there's a more emotional crowd that gets involved than the one at Anfield, which, you know, Shankly recognised 60, 70 years ago, whatever it is now. And Klopp realised. I mean, you know, when he left Dortmund, there was talk about him, Arsenal should get him and replace Wenger with Klopp and stuff. That wouldn't have been the right sort of fit. I think his personality, his attitude, his approach to everything just fits in perfectly at Anfield. And if anybody was going to get people believing again, it was him. Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to go to that European Cup final, Champions League Cup final, at Wembley, the Munich Dortmund one. And the Dortmund, I was actually in the midst of the Dortmund support, which is the most amazing thing to be, you know, in the middle of. I mean, they were phenomenal, and they lost the game and so on. But that's the kind of closest thing you can think of being, you know, within that Liverpool support. And I think he was the man best suited to harness it. I mean, you know, you know better than anybody else. What is it that on the Kop or within Anfield, what is it that you're looking for as a manager? What, you know, what is your ideal person to come in? What was it about Klopp that got people on side so quickly?
I think Klopp, it came down to personality. Personality, vision, a clear vision, always makes a big difference to you know, the Liverpool congregation. And I think just that general feeling that, you know, the manager who comes in, it's an often used phrase, but gets us, you know, has always been a big thing for Liverpool supporters, that buys into it. You know, we feel that they can buy into it as much as we do. You know, certainly in traditional sense, it's so much harder to do in the contemporary game with the way it changes. But, you know, the core support, yeah, there's just that element that it means as much to them as it does to us. You know, and it's hugely important in that respect. You know, there was a kinship felt with Benitez. There was with Julio as well. You know, Roy Evans was one of our own. You know, and all of this, there was an unease about Brendan Rodgers to a great deal of the time. 3.5 years in charge and away from that 2013-14 season where the impossible very nearly happened, it was highly dysfunctional. You know, what he led. You know, Roy Hodgson, we just tried to hop over that a little bit there as you know, it never really happened. But, you know, going back to Dalglish, you know, for my time, you know, Paisley, you know, a deity. Shankly before my time, you know, he resigned what, about 3 months after I was born, something like that. But, you know, we always knew the importance of Shankly. Remember the death of Shankly, and you know, it was as deep an impact as the death of John Lennon. John Lennon, a son of Liverpool, you know, Bill Shankly, you know, an adopted son of Liverpool, but, you know, two icons, you know, on, I don't know, equal footing as far as the city of Liverpool's concerned, but ask Liverpool fans which one means more. The point to the one that was born in Glenbuck, I'm sure. As much as we love what, you know, John Lennon did and represented and created. But yeah, as far as our football managers go, to feel like it means as much to them as it does to us. And you know, and it did to, you know, throughout my lifetime following Liverpool, it did mean that much to Bob Paisley, did mean that much to Joe Fagan and Kenny Dalglish. Jurgen Klopp has kind of brought it back to that. You know, he is an equal to that generation, really. You know, Benitez and Julio did buy into it and kind of got it and assimilated. And the, you know, the Benitez family stayed on Liverpool. He's got kids who are scouts, you know, and all of that. You know, Klopp has that element to him. He took it further than they did, I think, because he just felt like he was one of us. It's hard to put a definitive, you know, spin on it, but, you know, in simplistic terms, that, you know, it just to them, they buy into it. They fall for us in the same way we fall for them. And in respects to Jurgen Klopp, it's just come across as being massively mutual. But David, you know, Klopp's arrival and you know, speaking in terms of him being gone already, and we've still got, you know, 4 months of the three to four months of the season to go. I think early kind of notifications of manager leaving doesn't always kind of bring the positive that maybe they think it will do. Can you see this being a pattern at Liverpool, or do you think they can rise above that?
That's been carefully considered and needs to be. It can suck the life out of a season, but it could also galvanise a season for various reasons. It could galvanise a season because players are in the shop window for the new manager or whoever that is coming in, and they need to show themselves in that shop window. But in this case, there's something else going on. Klopp's got that deep connection with the club and the fans, but he's also got that deep connection with the players. There's loads of quotes from the players about how much they love him, how much they want to play for him, and loads of comments from him about how much he loves the players. And I think it's an opportunity for those players to invest themselves in trying to celebrate the end of his reign and trying to achieve as much as possible for him. And there was a story that I read that Klopp was a bit concerned that when he went past the changing room after he announced to everyone this, that there was going to be a deathly silence. And there wasn't. There was the hubbub from the players who were saying how much they're going to commit themselves to winning those trophies for him. So it can go either way, but I suspect with the deep complicity he's got with the players that this could be a galvanising factor. Now, the only other thing to say about that, I guess it also brings a pressure on the players that this is the one and last time you can win things for him. And, you know, people talk very easily about quadruples these days, but they're big old tasks to take on. But they're in a positive place and they can grasp that. Just to mirror a couple of things you said earlier, I do think he had a big task to address the expectations and belief at Liverpool and re-establish it. As you said, a lot of people had struggled with that, Stephen. The players had to feed off of Klopp's belief, despite his own lack of disbelief, I think, because although he's a charismatic, infectious character and he would stimulate belief, I think it's the loss to Real Madrid in the Champions League was his sixth consecutive final that he'd lost. And you need to keep your belief as a coach when you're on a run like that. You talked about him changing the mindset. Yeah, I think he did. I think he also changed the mentality. And we have to say, really, that in the short space of 4 years, he took what was at the time a mediocre Premier League side. Sorry, Stephen. To Champions League winners. You know, to Champions League winners in 4 years, that's a really quick transformation. And you mentioned his investment. And I think he's obviously personally and genuinely invested in that club and that project. You couldn't act your way through that. And he's almost like a throwback in that regard to those players we had in the 70s. Or you mentioned the player and you knew the club. And, you know, Steve Perryman with Spurs or something like that. You know, it was always a name, a club. And it's almost like that sort of investment that he had. And you mentioned about at times Liverpool having been dysfunctional in the past. I think he brought harmony. I think you need to look at coaches' backgrounds to see where some of their stuff is coming from. And he's got quite a religious background and he comes from a rural, hard-working area. So hard work characterises what he does, but faith in the project characterises what he does as well. And that's paid off quite a lot.
Within this, I've mentioned Liverpool's kind of like pattern of reaching out for the league title and missing out. Throughout Evans and you know, Houllier, Benitez, Rodgers, you know, they all had a compelling pop at the league title that fell short. Could any other manager other than Jurgen Klopp have broke that spell for Liverpool?
I think you'd perhaps have to look at Guardiola, given all the things that he's achieved. You know, you'd have to say that if he'd gone there and been given the tools, then he perhaps would have done so. It's very, very difficult to look at anybody else at that time that could have come in and you know, created that belief, that momentum. I do measure everything by Bill Shankly. That's my nature. And he is, in that sense, as close to Bill Shankly as probably any other manager has been in that intervening period, I think, you know, in terms of his personality and his you know, the way he mobilises things. And, you know, all those things that Bill Shankly used to say, you know. I mean, Klopp hasn't got quite the same turn of phrase. He wouldn't have. I mean, he's not speaking in his native language. But, you know, he hasn't quite got the, you know, Chairman Mao has never seen such a show of red strength or, you know, bastion of invincibility or any of that kind of stuff that he had with Shankly. But all the stuff that he said and the way he behaved and, the chest beating and the going onto the pitch and all of that, in a modern world, that would be a very Shankly kind of thing to do. You could see that being Shankly's approach to things as well. And I think after that, you can hardly call it being in the wilderness, because Liverpool won, I don't know how many European Cups, they won a couple more Champions Leagues and all that sort of stuff. But in terms of the first division, the Premier League, after such a long period of time, you kind of feel that you're cursed. You're never going to win the damn thing again, I'm sure. I think it needed somebody like that that was gonna convert. You've got to. There are only a very, very few managers in world football, I think, that could have done it. And Guardiola and Klopp, I think, are possibly the two that I would look at. I'm not sure if anybody else would have gone into Liverpool and turned them into a title-winning team, particularly against, you know, having to do it against this Manchester City as well. I mean, Klopp's been unfortunate in that sense. You know, in another era, he would have four league titles now. You know, it's unfortunate from his perspective that he's come up against Guardiola, equipped with the multi millions that Manchester City have got, you know, to keep them at the pinnacle. But I think those two are the only two I can think of really at that stage that would have made that difference.
I mean, David, stepping stones are a huge thing in you know, as far as I'm concerned, in Klopp's Liverpool. I think it was about, I don't know, the January, maybe the late January of 2016. He'd been in the job for about two and a half months. And there was a trip to Carrow Road for a particularly mad 9-goal seesaw of a match in which Adam Lallana scores the winning goal and Klopp breaks his glasses in celebration on the touchline. This was a result that, I don't know, I think Liverpool, it edged them past teams such as Stoke City and Watford in the league table to move them up to seventh and on the cusp of, you know, Europa League attempted qualification. But I always remember the reaction of the players and the reaction in the stands to that goal, defended terribly at times, you know, missed a hatful of chances, still scored five, had been 4-3 up in the 90th minute, chipped an equaliser 2 minutes into injury time to get the winner a couple of minutes later. But it was a definitive game. It was a definitive stepping stone in that kind of communion between the players, the fans and the manager, which harks back to the Shankly ethos, is that, you know, nothing else matters. It's those three elements. The way that Klopp could kind of have that springboard effect, that feel-good factor, that game itself shouldn't be, you know, underestimated in the development of Klopp's, I don't know, thinking, is the way that he brought the feel-good factor back to Liverpool.
Yeah, I love the word you use, communion. That's really good. I'm nicking that. in terms of kind of his mission and using games like that as a catalyst for further development, I mean, I actually reread some of my notes on some of his biographies, and one of the things that stood out for me was that he said, "I'm not interested in winning, I'm interested in development." So that win might have been important, but he'd be taking ideas from all of those things, as you say, stepping stones. And one of the things he said, which I liked as an analogy for building your relationship with players in a club, he talked about we're creating stories, we're creating common memories. And, you know, those games that stand out as those turning points are then become the kind of fuel for further development. So I agree with you. Those stepping stones are really important. And it doesn't matter if you played badly on that day, because it's not about how you played. It's not about whether you won. It's how you develop from there. And he's always looking for new ideas. He's always looking to develop further. You know, even early in his career, I think he was the guy who brought in the, what was it called? Was it the football nought? The robot that kept firing the balls out to the players so they had to play at different angles. So, you know, he's open to these new ideas, open to learning, and then every game can be a learning exercise and every stepping stone can be maximised towards improving the project.
the way that Klopp kind of, I don't know, he used that first half, half season, two-thirds of a season, you know, took them to a League Cup final that they lost on penalties to Manchester City, you know, took them to UEFA Cup final that they lost from 1-0 up at half-time to lose 3-1 to Sevilla. You know, these were kind of potential, I don't know, not hammer blows as such, but the continued disappointments for a supporter base that 2 years earlier had you know, suffered that near miss on the league title, had been licking the wounds somewhat, yet, you know, it was still used as a kind, and then again, it was these finals being lost were used as a, I don't know, a stick to beat Klopp because he, you know, he had this propensity or this history of losing finals. But what it seemed to do was, you know, rather than kind of, I don't know, drag the club down, it galvanised them.
I was just looking at the sort of the list of Liverpool seasons through that period, and yeah, you kind of forget. You obviously wouldn't forget, but you forget how unsuccessful Liverpool were through that period. You know, I mean, the 2006, there was the, you know, there were two trophies in 2006, and then there was a League Cup in 2012, and that was it over that period until Klopp had come in. So, you know, it wasn't as though Liverpool was still, okay, they're not winning the league, but they're winning the FA Cup every year, couple of years, and they're winning in Europe, and they're doing this, that, and the other. It was a barren period per se, and I think getting to the two finals just reinforced belief. Okay, they weren't won, but they were finals. It's a little bit of progress, and I think, yeah, I mean, again, we keep going back to his personality and the way that he, you know, created that bond with the supporters very early. He has a couple of seasons where he's not won anything. Now, I know this is only 6-7 years ago, but come to today, and if you're at a Liverpool or, you know, a Chelsea or a whatever, would you get two seasons without winning anything and still be in your job? I'm not sure that you would. You know, and that's how fast football is changing in a really short period of time. But I think those two finals gave encouragement to everybody to think, okay, this fella's got an idea, he knows what he's doing, he's moving us in the right direction. And then just the compelling nature of the way he communicated with supporters and with players gave everybody reason to think, oh, okay, we are moving in the right direction. There's a lot going on at that point. But I just think there are certain people, you know, all the way through football management that can take people with them. And he's one of those. He's one of those. And even when things aren't going well, people will still believe in what he's going to do. They still think it'll be okay in the end.
Absolutely. I mean, David, just having a look here at that first few months and at the club, and you know, there's the 3-1 win. I think sacks Mourinho. I think there's this kind of like the 4-1 win at Manchester City. You know, there are reasons to feel, you know, very, very quickly. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a 2-1 defeat at home to Crystal Palace, there's a defeat at Newcastle, the draw against West Brom, there's a loss at the Vicarage Road against Watford 3-0. So, you know, there's still these quite cataclysmic performances here and there, West Ham 2-0. But what I'm looking at there is, like, by mid to late November, not much more than a month and a half in having been in charge, He's changed the shape of his side. He's turned it into the team that is still recognisable now, the shape and the pattern of play. You know, he's introduced that you know, the gegenpressing that was always kind of like used. You know, what we used to know was kind of like, you know, the attack being the first line of defence, you know, in Bob Paisley's days. You know, he's turned it 4-3-3 from 4-3-2-1 or whatever the system was. You know, he's very, very quickly got in there and said, this is the way that we're going to play. I might not necessarily have the players that I want to be able to I don't know, pull off the job, you know, and to do these positions the way that I want to, but I am now going to implement the style of play that I want, the formation that I want, and then we'll add the players in, you know, as we go along. You know, it's massively impressive to turn around, you know, for a new manager to come in, to go safety first, you know, to go to Manchester City, to go to Stamford Bridge and say, nah, you know, we'll play three up front, you know, and they've gone to Chelsea and Manchester City within a short space of time then and scored 7 goals between the two games as a mid-table side. it's impressive. His own belief, you know, it's one thing selling that kind of believe in what I'm doing to kind of like the supporters, to the players, you know, to the owners of the club. But it's clear from word go that there's no problem with his own self-belief in his own abilities as well.
No, I think he's imposing his character there, isn't he? And he's kind of melding his identity with that of the club and the playing side and their playing style. And I think a strength of Klopp is his being himself, his authenticity. A little bit like Postecoglou now, you know, they get players sent off, he still attacks. Like, he's going to be himself. He's going to play three up front against a strong side. He's not going to go defensive. So you get a clear idea about who he is and what he's about. And again, the fans can connect with that. There's a genuineness that they can connect with, which I think is really important. Just going back to the thing we've talked about how you view a failure can depend on whether you progress further or reel back. And I think it's a really fascinating area, that. And, you know, the Klopp run of six final defeats is one we've talked about already. But the greatest example of that in Klopp's reign at Liverpool is when I think they get the third highest total, don't they, ever in the Premier League of points and come second to Man City. And then the next season, I think they win the league. Now, that is strength of character in a project, you know, because you've gone third highest and you've got to go again. And they choose to go again and they get past it. So that's a wonderful thing we can say about the manager, that he helps the team to not only get over failure, but to use the failure to galvanise them, as you said earlier. So I think that's really useful.
I mean, Dave, there's a ruthlessness at play as well here. You know, I'm looking at his first summer in charge, and you know, yeah, even as a Liverpool fan, you tend to forget certain things. But you know, he brings in six players and ships out 16. You know, there's kind of like his dispensing of Christian Benteke, you know, who the club has paid a lot of money for under Brendan Rodgers, and then he's just taken a look at him and thought, no, you're not for me, out you go. You know, and it's kind of, you know, you're looking at the list of players that go, and there's no real mistakes there. You know, within that first summer, in comes Joe Matip, in comes Sadio Mane, Jorginho Wijnaldum. You know, there's kind of like a very clear vision in what he wants to do, unfolding very, very swiftly.
Again, that's the mark of great management, isn't it? You know, you recognise what it is that you want to do. You recognise who can do it for you. You recognise who can't do it for you. And you act accordingly. You know, I mean, a lot of managers sort of won't grasp the nettle when it comes to, you know, crowd favourites or whatever. You know, they won't necessarily bin him off. You know, I mean, you know, going back to Steven Gerrard, I think he was perhaps fortunate that Steven Gerrard was no longer around in that team when he came along, you know. He doesn't have to deal with that. But yeah, as you say, he obviously got a very clear pattern of play that he wanted to impose on Liverpool. It was a kind of method of playing. And fair play to the people at Liverpool for getting him, because they understood that the way he wanted to play was the way Liverpool fans wanted to watch their football. And it fitted in with the culture of the club and the traditions of the club. So yeah, that makes perfect sense as well. But in the finish, it doesn't matter what you do, the manager is the one who's going to carry the can if it goes wrong. So I think, you know, the best managers accept the fact that, okay, I'm the one that's going to be in the firing line. I'm the one that's going to take all the flak. I'm the one that's going to get it in the neck. We'll do it my way. Alf Ramsey was the perfect example of that. I'm the one that's going to carry the can. We're going to do it my way. Thanks very much. I don't care what the press say. I don't care what anybody in the team say. We're doing it this way. And I think, you know, there has to be a touch of the megalomaniac about anybody who wants to be a football manager at that kind of level. There's got to be, because, you know, you've got to... I can't imagine being a football manager without having that kind of ironclad self-belief. It must be absolute torture to be in that job and not be entirely sure of what it is that you're doing, right or wrong. If you don't believe in that, it must be agony. Week after week after week, going through all of that. I don't think there was that much self-doubting in what Klopp was doing. I think he always felt that if he got his players in if they understood what it was that he wanted to do, that, you know, he would prevail in the end. As I say, you know, he was then presented with Manchester City with all that money and Pep Guardiola, and that obviously didn't help any at all. But as David says, you know, you go and collect all those points in the Premier League, it's still not enough. I mean, it's very, very difficult to come back the following August and start doing all that again from zero. That is a major achievement, and that again speaks to the fact that it's somebody with supreme self-belief. I don't think you can get away from that. And I think in all the great managers, you know, we talk about tactics, we talk about communication with the fans, we talk, you know, all of those things, that ability to spot a player or whatever. But I think above all else, before you start, you've got to have absolute supreme self-belief. And I think, you know, he's certainly got that.
I mean, David, his first full season in charge of Liverpool, he takes them to Champions League qualification. You know, they narrowly edge out Arsenal, but it's a huge stepping stone. You know, within a year, you know, well, the following summer, you know, Mo Salah arrives for prices that just, you know, seem ludicrous in footballing terms now, at just under £44 million, Mohamed Salah. Andy Robertson for like £7 million. You know, Virgil van Dijk comes in off the back of the sale of Philip Coutinho, and then Alisson Becker would come. Now, this kind of, I don't know, it's startling just how quickly he turns things around in so many respects. Just not much more than 2.5 years. I look at it and think he's just been so omnipresent and so, I don't know, part of the fabric of Liverpool, and seems so natural there. It's coming up to 9 years that he's been in charge. It feels so much longer in so many respects. And being so eye of the storm and what's happening now, I look at those early days. It amazes me that he went from picking up the club in the October of 2015, and then it's less than 3 years he has them in Champions League final. And that particular Liverpool that he picked up, and I say they went to Manchester City, they went to Chelsea as a mid-table side and picked up those results in his early days. It's pretty startling, really. And as part of that, it's that concept that getting the players to buy into it. You know, in Philip Coutinho, there was a player who was either didn't buy into it, or he was just in too much of a rush to do it, you know, somewhere else.
Dave talked about the immense self-belief that coaches have to have. Yeah, I agree with that. And what comes before that, in a way, is knowing yourself really well. If you don't know yourself really well, you're not in touch with your beliefs. And, you know, there's some really smart recruitment goes on that you just talked about. So you've got to know yourself well there in terms of what players do you want and why, how they're going to fit into your system, what is your system. You've also got to have the vision if you're going to sell an idea to players. And he's got the clear vision that we talked about earlier. So, but he's also got the charismatic ability to communicate that vision and to pull people along with it, back to the Menschenfänger idea. I think it was Cruyff used to say, you've got to die with your own ideas. So, you know, you've got to be all in to your own ideas as a coach on the pitch and how it's going to work. And if you're all in and you do sell your clear vision and you do buy players that fit and you get rid of other players, I think he got rid of Balotelli pretty quickly, didn't he? He didn't felt fit. Then you've got a really good chance of transformation in the short term, because everybody's noses are pointed in the right direction. Going back to the point about him making decisions ultimately, he's always had a very strong interdisciplinary support team. He's always had very strong number two, number three around him, and that's a really good thing as well. It helps to take the pressure off the head coach. It gives them a sounding board. It gives people who can check and challenge them. However, he says very clearly that after all of that deliberation, the decision is down to him. And ultimately, that's a huge responsibility that plays into maybe what we're talking about today, you know, with him going or seeming to go early. So there's that huge pressure of decision making. Yes, you've got the wonderful people around you and the wonderful project, but it's going to take a toll, because passionately selling those ideas, passionately bringing in players and developing projects such as how we develop Robertson and Alexander-Arnold, you know, it's wonderful, it's transformational, but it's going to have a cost. What did I read the other day? It's about something different, but it's kind of like you can survive this, but not unaltered. So, you know, if you've got a big project, it will alter you.
I mean, Dave, within that, it's all to them. You know, Klopp pointed out in his press conference about how, you know, it's been 9 years, and you know, look at a picture of me when I walked through the door, and look at a picture of me now. You know, and I totally get that. You know, there's no doubt about it. The job has aged him, but a point in his life that, you know, he's entitled to start aging. You know, I think we all are. Is I don't know, his sense of belief to be able to instill that in everyone that surrounds him. I'm trying to get to the socialist side of him here. You know, and those mirrors with Bill Shankly in making everyone feel part of it. And, you know, he's done the same with kind of like, you know, the catering staff, anyone at the training complex. I don't know, that concept of belief from the ground up, you know, it takes a certain personality, a certain individual to do that, certainly in this era.
I think in this era, it's incredibly difficult. You know, I mean, we talk about Shankly or Clough or Revie or whatever it was in that 70s era of great managers. And they had a great degree of control over everything because they didn't manage a team, they managed the football club, they managed everything. And that's not the same now, whoever you are, because football's infinitely more complicated. There are infinitely more people involved at any football club. You know, the staff and so on is through the roof compared to what it was, you know, 30, 40 years ago, actually 20 years ago. You can only do that by force of your personality. And you know, it is the Shankly thing about the socialism, I believe, is everybody sharing the rewards and sharing the work, that kind of thing. And I think that, again, that's gone back to what I was saying earlier. That's why Klopp was such a good fit for Liverpool, because he believes in that kind of thing. And that's what Liverpool has been built on since, you know, the late 1950s. He fits into that pattern altogether. You know, I mean, in his way, Alex Ferguson was the same at Manchester United. You know, he was always going on about everybody from the tea lady upwards has to be pointing to the same, you know, to the top of the mountain. We all have to be going the same way. That is, again, you have to be that kind of personality at a club of that scale to be able to inspire people, not just the people that you're talking to for hours on end every week in the dressing room and in team meetings and all of that, but to, you know, literally to the tea lady, to the ground staff, to the people you bump into for 10 seconds every day, you know, for those people to think that you care about them as well. It drives that little bit to we talk nowadays about marginal gains all the time, don't we? Those are some of those marginal gains. You know, you get the ground staff does a slightly better job on the pitch, you know, the media department is slightly better at putting out the messages. All of that stuff, you know, it ultimately adds up. And, you know, when you've got to get 100 points to win the Premier League, that in the end can make a difference. I think, you know, you're right about that sort of socialist aspect to it, about we are all in this together, we are all pushing in the same direction, and you are as important. Every one of us has a contribution to make, I think, is crucial. And that was crucial in getting the supporters on side. And, you know, I'm sure we'll come onto this game in a bit, but, you know, there is no other football manager, and, you know, I include Guardiola in that, and no other football club that I can imagine beating Barcelona 4-0 in the semi-final of a Champions League, having lost the first leg, other than Klopp and Liverpool. I cannot think of anybody in the last 20. You know, Ferguson wouldn't have done it with Manchester United, I'm sure. I don't think Guardiola could have done it with Manchester City, but there's a religious fervour that surrounds Klopp in a sense when it's going right at Anfield, that made that result possible. And I don't think that would have happened anywhere else.
David, this is kind of like the realms of mad voodoo. I was there that night at Anfield for the 4-0 comeback against Barcelona. And bizarre as it was, the night before there being the blow of Vincent Kompany hitting a screamer from the car park against them, was Leicester possibly, that kind of like, you know, tilted the title their way. And here we were going into this game 3-0 down to Barcelona the following night. And I can remember stood on Flagpole Corner chatting to various people that I see before matches. You know, some people who were there, who were just kind of like, there's just absolutely no chance here. And I can remember turning around and saying, well, you know, we can win it. Whether we will, you know, it's transfer, and it's making the difference between what you can do and what you will do. And I said, you know, I think, you know, I said, whether we will or not is another matter, that'll unfold. But, you know, we can do it, you know, and that's the way that, you know, Klopp kind of changed the mentality of supporters, even kind of like people like me and people who are older than me who'd seen it all before, maybe that little bit more, you know, I don't know, ground down by it all. But had that experience of seeing stuff and knowing when there's something in the water. But that night against Barcelona was the making of Klopp and Anfield and the making of the contemporary Liverpool.
It's the making of a legend, isn't it? I wasn't in the ground. I was watching it on telly, but you still got the feel of it and the momentum of it and the sheer collective force that made it happen. You felt like the fans were part of that collective force. And it's all part of those social ideals that Dave's been talking about. And Klopp is the spiritual leader of that collective force. You know, and the phrase they use about him is, he made believers out of doubters. You know, and you had to believe to make it happen that night, not just the players, but the fans and creating the spirit. And that's really one of his greatest strengths, isn't it? You know, he's able to be the spiritual leader that lifts everybody's belief up and creates legendary nights and memories like that night.
I mean, Dave, going back to that night, it's interesting though, to point out just who was missing that night for Liverpool. It was a result that you know, as much as anyone would want to believe it was possible. You know, there was no Salah. He was stood on the touchline with his, you know, the T-shirt with the slogan on it that slips my mind. But there was no Firmino that night as well. He opted to, you know, leave Wijnaldum on the bench and play James Milner. There was a lot of head scratching going on around me prior to kickoff. But, you know, it's the way that he made such a cult hero to someone like Divock Origi, a player with the limitations and, you know, the manner of the clinching goal. You know, I can remember being up in the, and it, I don't know, it was the first season of the new main stand, but certainly before, you know, the extension of the Anfield Road end. So from my point, I could always see into Stanley Park prior to the, you know, the new build of the Anfield Road end. And I can always remember the noise of Anfield when that fourth goal went in. Possibly the third goal. I think the fourth was just, it was the bedlam, but the incredulity of it all. The car lights flashing all over Stanley Park car park. The noise setting off the car alarms, basically. There was just hundreds of them. The lights just going boom, 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 boom. You know, no matter what he does between now and the end of the season, you know, there's just, an indelible imprint that will just never diminish there for Klopp at Liverpool.
I think, getting deeply philosophical about this, ever since Nietzsche decided that there was no God, we've been looking for something to fill the God-shaped hole, and we've concluded that football does it. More than anything else, I think that's what we've as a society we've kind of alighted upon. Those are the nights. They're old time prayer meetings, aren't they? They're old time religion. That's what it is. It's the gospel singing. It's that whole communion. It's the belief in something outside yourself. It's belief in miracles, I suppose. In a way, that football has become the religious experience. Really, you know, we go to these cathedrals on a Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, or we used to, and you go whatever time you go now. But that's what football has become. And, you know, I think increasingly, particularly in more recent years, we've tried to reduce football into a science. And I think VAR is another thing that's coming apart as part of this. And we try to turn something that's this visceral, elemental, emotional thing that gives meaning to people's lives into something that we should be able to turn into algorithms and it should be some scientific thing. And, you know, I understand why coaches want to make things scientific and they want to get rid of all the variables and make it so that everything plays out the way that it ought to. And that's I absolutely understand that because they're professionals. But bugger that. That's not what football's about, really, in the end. Football's about getting people, you know, together, and it's lifting you out of the mundane. And Klopp understood that. And, yeah, there are managers in non-league football that understand that, managers in League Two who aren't, you know, as successful and perhaps aren't as tactically astute and pick the wrong players and all that kind of stuff. But they understand that bit. And they have some longevity out of that because they tap into something very basic in people. And I think, you know, they are the modern-day preachers that used to go around, and you know, they're the John Wesleys or whatever that used to get people engaged and whipped up into frenzy. And I think, you know, over the course of the last 20 odd years, Klopp has been the one that's been better at that than anybody. And I think that's why, you know, a lot of people over the last couple of days have been saying, well, you know, whatever you think about Liverpool and all of that, I wish Klopp had managed our club, because that he kind of gets, not just that he gets Liverpool, he gets football, he gets the emotion, he gets the base stupidity of it all, basically, in the finish, I think.
I mean, David, to Liverpool fans, he'll always be this, you know, I don't know, he'll always bring a smile to the face, you know, from that, you know, the Barcelona to Madrid, you know, win the Champions League, bring the Premier League finally the following season, you know, there's, a shot at the quadruple that fell half short in the end. You know, the league title lost despite a ludicrous amount of points, and actually lost the Champions League final, where I thought we were the better team, actually, for large swathes of that game. But yeah, on an evening where other distractions kind of, you know, made an imprint. And within that, you know, Klopp's, I don't know, the way he backed the fans coming away from Paris, you know, in the way UEFA dealt with it so badly, you know, and it was how it went further, you know, Klopp's kind of, I don't know, you look at kind of like COVID, the loss of his mother, and you know, he couldn't go back and, you know, mourn, you know, at the funeral of his mother and stuff like that, but is back into the NHS during COVID, and this other creeping propensity of media at press conferences wanting to know his opinion about things outside the sphere of football. You know, it was bizarre in many respects how he's become. You know, I think he's tried to remove himself away from that a lot more of recent times. But, you know, a go-to talking head on day-to-day occurrences in social aspects.
Yeah, I think he's bigger than football in a lot of ways. You know, people want to know what his opinions are about broader things. And I think that broader aspect helps him with his job as well. So if I link to something that Dave said, Klopp does use science, and he's got, you know, a lot of scientists that support him. But what he's able to do, he's able to apply science more effectively because of the relationships he deliberately cultivates with the players and the practitioners. You know, so science becomes the servant of the whole project, not the master, which is what Dave's not comfortable with, and I'm not either. You know, coaching has always been a science and an art, but it's more about art than science. It's how you apply the science that's really important. So it's never going to be down to algorithms, etc. You're always going to need the coach there who's emotionally embedded and invested in the project. And yeah, Klopp's obviously got political ideas, etc. You know, when he's announced this, a lot of people are saying, what will he do next? It wouldn't surprise you if he went into a political role. It sounds like he's going to take a break, right? He's going to take a break for a year to recharge. And there's a bit of a parallel there, I guess, with Pep, who had that break after the Barcelona 4 years that absolutely exhausted him. And I guess the parallel we could think about there just briefly is when a coach is a spiritual leader like Klopp is and like Pep was, and they therefore take on a lot more in terms of responsibility, communicating to players and fans and the club as such as an identity. And that's got to be more exhausting. So, you know, the more you invest yourself in a club, you get the wonderful connections with people, but it's also going to have the emotional cost that comes with that.
Absolutely. He's definitely going to leave a void behind him in many, you know, many, many elements. As a final one, it's Dave, you go to your, I mean, I do this for the decades episodes. You go to Jurgen Klopp image. I say Jurgen Klopp to you. What is it that's going to spring to mind?
And for me, it is that game against West Brom, you know, that I spoke about earlier. I mean, it was a very unusual thing to see from a manager at that point in time, particularly in a mundane league match against increasingly even more mundane opposition, sadly. But, you know, at the time it made an impact, and it's only made a bigger and bigger impact as the years have gone on, actually, because, you know, you have come to understand more and more about what it meant and why he did it and the personality behind it, and you see it in the round. So it would have to be that. It would have to be that game against West Brom.
Excellent, excellent. David, yourself?
Yeah, I'll go back to what I said earlier when the fans were leaving early. When they were losing, I think, and he said he felt alone, and he used that to not attack the fans, but to remind the fans that they had a common project. And I think that links then to the three kind of things that I would think of if I think about Klopp, which is number one, and these are in order, authenticity, number two, emotion, and number three, belief. So he's showing his genuineness about being concerned about them leaving early. He's generating emotion in the common project, and we need to be in this together. And therefore, he's stimulating belief that they can improve things, transform things, and achieve higher things together, which they did under him. And, you know, we've got to give a lot of respect for that. As we said, he transformed them very quickly over a short period of time to Champions League winners.
Absolutely. I mean, the three core elements there that you mentioned very much tick the boxes of Liverpoolians. You know, and when we said earlier on that, feelings, the need for a Liverpool manager that kind of feels the way that we do about the team, you know, is you know, mirrors that. Before we started recording, David came up with the great idea of three words to sum up Jurgen Klopp. David, have you got one for? Have you got a three word mission statement come mantra when it comes to Jurgen Klopp?
I went too early with my authenticity, belief, and emotion because they're my three.
We can take that. We can take that as a double there. Dave.
Well, given it's Jurgen Klopp and it's Liverpool, you have to go to Lennon and McCartney all together now.
Excellent. Excellent stuff. I'll go for another Bill Shankly.
Controversial.
Controversial, but oh, an element of truth in there as well. Thank you so much, Dave. It's been a wonderful way to spend an hour eulogising about one of my favourite human beings of all time.
It's been very interesting. I think the one thing we can say is that English football won't be the same next season.
Absolutely, absolutely. And David, thank you so much for all your contributions. Brilliant as always.
Yeah, very welcome. And I think thinking about this and talking about this reminds us what a unique coach Klopp is, and you know, we're unlikely to see quite this sort of coach again. I think he's quite unusual, and in some ways a bit of a throwback, as we say, that links to Shankly, etc. But a wonderful fit for Liverpool, and they've got a tough job finding a successor.
Totally, totally. About 3.5 months more to enjoy him, as far as my perspective is concerned, and I'll be at Anfield tomorrow for the Norwich game, which will be it'll be intriguing to see. And the thing is, what you'll get with the Norwich game and the Chelsea game in midweek is two, I don't know, you'll get a lot of people who are at the Norwich game tomorrow who won't be there on Wednesday night, and a lot of people who will be there on Wednesday night won't be there on Sunday afternoon, simply because of the way that the tickets are sold and some people opt out of FA Cup games, and you know, there'll be two very different demographics. It's going to be interesting. So it'll be kind of like almost two rapturous, you know, receptions that you'll get. You'll get the ones coming in on Wednesday night thinking, I wish I was there on Sunday, and trying to make up for it. But yeah, it's going to be, probably not a dry eye in the house as far as red-tinged individuals are concerned. Thank you so much. That's been brilliant. all that leaves me to say is please do join us again next time on the podcast from These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.